content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service would like to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the February 24th, 2017 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. North Korea missile launch tests Trump. What happened? The Trump administration faced its first major national security challenge this week after North Korea successfully launched an intermediate-range ballistic missile and edged closer toward dictator Kim Jong-un's goal of developing a nuclear-capable rocket that could reach the U.S. The Pugukseong-2 missile traveled some 310 miles toward Japan before splashing down in international waters east of the Korean Peninsula. Believed to be an upgrade of a submarine-launched version Pyongyang tested last year, the missile is thought to have a maximum range of more than 1,200 miles. That's still some 2,000 miles short of the closest U.S. soil, but a clear threat to regional allies Japan and South Korea. President Trump learned of the launch while dining with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Palm Beach, Florida. Obviously, North Korea is a big, big problem, he said at a news conference 2 days later, and we will deal with that very strongly. It was more measured language than Trump used last month when Kim threatened to test an intercontinental ballistic missile. It won't happen, Trump tweeted. The United Nations Security Council denounced the missile launch and urged members to redouble their efforts to implement UN sanctions against Pyongyang, which has conducted 5 nuclear tests, including 2 last year. Han Tae-song, North Korea's Geneva-based ambassador to the UN, insisted the launch was a self-defense measure needed to protect national sovereignty, what the editorial said. Trump's unusually muted response was prudent, said the Washington Post. There is nothing to be gained right now by drawing red lines, and there is no plausible military solution that does not risk a war and hundreds of thousands of deaths on the Korean Peninsula. The points to negotiation, China, North Korea's main sponsor, has urged the U.S. to restart talks with Pyongyang. If Trump gets to the table, it will be a critical test of his oft-touted deal-making skills. Sure, we should talk, said the Washington Times, but we can't ignore the fact that Kim is creeping toward developing an intercontinental missile capable of devastating the U.S. West Coast. Trump must follow through on the 2017 National Defense and Authorization Act, which called for the completion of a layered missile defense system capable of defending the entire U.S. homeland. The time to build a reliable shield is before doomsday, not in the ruins. What the columnist said, stop panicking. Pyongyang is unlikely to lob missiles or nuclear weapons at the U.S., said Isaac Stonefish in TheAtlantic.com. Kim wants to enjoy the trappings of power and knows that if he were to target Los Angeles or Seattle, his nation would be obliterated in a retaliatory strike. So unless North Korea chooses to commit suicide by declaring war on South Korea or Japan, dragging the U.S. into a ground war, it barely poses a military threat to America. This new missile might not present a direct threat to the U.S., but it does to our allies, said the economist. The Pugukseong 2 is a major breakthrough for the North because it uses solid fuel, which gives it greater mobility, durability, and ease of use, compared with its liquid fuel-powered predecessors. Solid fuel missiles don't have to travel with a retinue of tankers carrying propellant, which makes them easier to conceal from U.S. satellites and spy planes. And they can be launched with as little as 5 minutes' notice. So the Pugukseong 2 might be spotted by the U.S. only when it's already rocketing toward Japan, where more than 80,000 American troops are stationed. Handling North Korea is a team sport, and we need China, said former NATO Supreme Allied Commander James Stavridis in Time.com. Beijing is the North's economic lifeline, and without China on our side, further sanctions are useless. Winning China will require compromise, such as easing U.S. opposition to Chinese island building in the South China Sea. Of course, we should supplement any negotiations with muscle. Special operations forces should prepare for an invasion to take out Kim and the leadership. As in the past, we can also offer carrots to Kim, such as food assistance, alongside sticks, like deeper sanctions. There is no silver bullet, but the sooner we start dealing with Kim, the better. And before we leave this page, I'll read for you one of the short pieces under the heading, "It Wasn't All Bad." An Auschwitz survivor and the Scottish commando who saved her celebrated their 71st Valentine's Day together this week. John Mackey, 96, helped liberate a number of prisoners from the concentration camp, including Hungarian Jew Edith Steiner, now 92. The two met at a village dance to celebrate the prisoners' liberation and have been together ever since. They married in 1946 and eventually settled in Dundee, Scotland, where this year the couple rang in February 14th at a party in their senior citizen's home. "It's lovely to have such a real example of true love with us," said one staff member. Controversy of the week. Trump, can he regain control of his presidency? Less than a month after Donald Trump took the oath of office, said Jeet here in NewRepublic.com, the infighting, chaos, and ineptitude within his White House are making the president look weaker every day. He got off to a bad start with his obsessive concern over his popular vote deficit, rushed out a poorly drafted executive order banning travel from seven Muslim-majority nations, and this week was caught up in the scandal surrounding the resignation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. The deeper problem is that after a lifetime of running a family business, Trump doesn't know how government works, has no coherent management structure, and is being undermined by a daily torrent of leaks to the media by aides jockeying for position. Morale within the White House is in freefall, said Alex Eisenstadt in Politico.com. And insiders say the president himself is deeply frustrated with the challenges of running the massive federal bureaucracy. Being president, his aides say, is harder than Donald Trump thought. Look, every new president goes through a shakeout period, said Michael Goodwin in nypost.com. These early stumbles are getting so much attention only because the opposition media and Democrats are united in trying to thwart his presidency. Trump mustn't let himself get distracted by the steady flow of leaks to the hostile press. To get back on track, he needs to stay focused on the big picture. Tax reform, jobs, border security, and rebuilding the military. In its desperation to delegitimize his presidency, the media is ignoring what Trump has already accomplished, said Kelly Riddell in the Washington Times. He's begun the process of building a wall, instituting extreme vetting of people from terrorist-prone nations, enforcing immigration laws, and filling the Supreme Court vacancy with a real conservative. As for the supposed chaos, Trump supporters voted for change and are thrilled he's mixing things up in Washington. I'm sorry, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com, but the idea that Trump's brilliant master plan is unfolding just as he intended is freaking bonkers. Trump pitched himself to voters as a super competent business executive who'd fix Washington. So far, he's got his travel ban stopped by a federal judge, lost his national security advisor to a growing FBI investigation, and can't seem to stop his top aides from stabbing each other and him in the back. Only a true Trumpist still believes the mastermind has everything under control. Trump supporters point to the pile of executive orders he signed as proof of his effectiveness, said Zachary Carabel in Politico.com. But nearly all of them are essentially statements of intent with no legal force. So far, this has been the illusion of a presidency, not the real thing. Can this presidency be saved? Asked Ross Douthat in NYTimes.com. Yes, of course. All Trump would have to do is drop the divisive tweeting and rhetoric and let competent cabinet officers such as Rex Tillerson and James Mattis take the lead on foreign policy and Jeff Sessions figure out an immigration enforcement agenda. Congressional Republican leaders should be given the responsibility of figuring out how to replace Obamacare. Trump would then be free to hammer away at a few simple popular projects, such as an infrastructure bill and a middle-class tax break. Yes, but does that sound like Trump? Said Richard Cohen in the Washington Post. He has spent his life indulging his narcissistic impulses, seeking vengeance against his enemies, and creating chaos, conflict, and drama. At the age of 70, Donald Trump is not about to grow up. It was a good week for amateur lawyers. After a minimally educated farmer in China who spent 16 years teaching himself law won a $120,000 settlement from a chemical company that had dumped toxic waste on his village's farmland. I knew I was in the right, Wang Inlin said. It was a good week for search parties after the Wales Coast Guard found a man believed to be lost at sea, safely drinking in a local pub. The man had been last seen cut off by the rising tide while walking on an estuary, but then turned up at the nearby Ship-Aground pub where he says he rescued himself. And it was a good week for the highest form of flattery. After a newspaper in the Dominican Republic published a picture of Alec Baldwin impersonating Donald Trump on Saturday Night Live and mistakenly identified the actor as President of the United States. But it was a bad week for ride sharing after a French businessman sued Uber for $48 million, claiming that a glitch in the ride sharing app software gave his wife notifications of his comings and goings, leading to accusations of infidelity and a nasty divorce. It was a bad week for typos after President Trump's official inauguration photo had to be pulled from the Library of Congress online store because of a misspelling. The autographed portrait featured the quote, "No dream is too big, no challenge is too great." T-O instead of T-O-O on the too great. And it was a bad week for flying solo after actor Harrison Ford, 74, mistakenly landed his single-engine Husky plane on a taxiway at a California airport, narrowly missing a passenger plane preparing for takeoff. "Was that airliner meant to be underneath me?" the actor asked air control. Before we move on, a couple of short pieces here, one titled Boring But Important. Cutting regulations. The Trump administration is overseeing one of the biggest regulatory rollbacks ever, according to a Washington Post investigation, using legislative and executive methods to dismantle rules governing how dentists dispose of mercury fillings, how schools look after disabled students, and more. GOP lawmakers have aided President Trump by using the 1996 Congressional Review Act to nullify eight different regulations that were enacted in the past 60 days and are considering another measure that would weaken environmental regulations on mining companies. Trump has also signed an executive order freezing new regulations for 60 days and has ordered agencies to eliminate or weaken two existing regulations for each new rule they enact. And an Only in America short, Tennessee lawmakers have proposed making it legal for drivers to run over protesters who block public streets. The Republican-sponsored legislation would protect motorists from civil liability if a protester were injured, provided the driver exercised due care. The bill comes 10 days after a car ran into people at a Nashville protest against President Trump's travel ban. Similar driving laws have been proposed in five other states. On the briefing page, NAFTA's legacy. Who won? Who lost? The trade deal many Americans blame for job losses has a complicated record of success and failure. What did NAFTA do? The North American Free Trade Agreement was a 1994 accord between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico that lifted tariffs on most products moving between the three nations. It was also the first trade agreement to include protections for intellectual property. NAFTA had bipartisan backing, having been negotiated by a Republican president, George H.W. Bush, and signed by his Democratic successor, Bill Clinton, after passing the Senate 61-38. But it has also met stiff opposition across the political spectrum. The nascent agreement was a flashpoint in the 1992 presidential race. A quarter century later, NAFTA and other free trade deals fueled a wave of populist anger among voters who blamed outsourcing for the major decline in U.S. manufacturing jobs. During the 2016 campaign, NAFTA was flogged relentlessly by Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders and by Republican Donald Trump, who called it the single worst trade deal ever approved in this country. Now President Trump says he will fulfill his campaign promise to renegotiate the pact. What was the rationale of the agreement? There were several goals. The U.S. wanted to bring Mexico's developing economy into the first world on the premise that creating jobs there would curb illegal immigration. As then Mexican President Carlos Salinas de Gortari put it, his country would export goods, not people. For the U.S. and Canada, meanwhile, Mexico was seen as fertile ground for exports and investment. President Clinton predicted that free trade would boost the economies of all three countries. NAFTA means jobs, he said, American jobs and good-paying American jobs. If I didn't believe that, I wouldn't support this agreement. So how did it work out? The broad consensus is that NAFTA has a mixed legacy. A 2015 report by the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service said the deal did not cause the huge job losses feared by the critics or the large economic gains predicted by the supporters, and called NAFTA's net effect on the U.S. economy relatively modest. Trade between the three signatories has grown considerably, from about $290 billion in 1993 to more than $1.1 trillion last year. Supporters say the agreement has helped employ 14 million Americans in fields such as retail, finance, and agriculture, and provided cheaper goods to U.S. consumers. About 5 million American jobs are directly tied to trade with Mexico, and 9 million are tied to trade with Canada, says University of Calgary economist Eugene Boileau. But critics argued that the downsides of NAFTA and other trade deals outweigh the benefits. What downsides? In the two decades since NAFTA, the balance of trade between the U.S. and Mexico flip-flopped from a $1.7 billion American surplus to a $49.2 billion deficit. Analysts such as Robert Scott of the Economic Policy Institute estimate that nearly 700,000 U.S. workers lost good jobs as a result, mostly in manufacturing. Those who kept their jobs saw wages flatline, at least partly because of Mexican competition. The most affected workers were college dropouts working in industries that depended heavily on tariff protections in place prior to NAFTA, said University of Virginia economist John McLaurin. But economists say that NAFTA alone didn't cause their pain, citing the rise of China as an economic powerhouse, the 2008 financial collapse, and above all, perhaps, automation and new technology that rendered many 20th century jobs obsolete. Did NAFTA help curb illegal immigration? Clearly, the deal hasn't delivered on that promise. The number of undocumented immigrants in the U.S. quadrupled after NAFTA signing from 3 million in 1994 to 12 million in 2007. The impact of Mexico's economic growth and wages also has not met expectations. While the country probably gained about 600,000 jobs in the manufacturing sector, it lost at least 2 million more in agriculture, thanks to cheap imports of U.S. corn and other produce. With their economy also weighed down by competition from China and a range of domestic factors, jobless Mexicans migrated to the U.S. at an unprecedented rate of 500,000 a year after NAFTA, says Laura Carlson of the nonprofit Center for International Policy. Since the Great Recession of 2008, however, the net influx has been negative, with more Mexican nationals returning to their home country than arriving. What does Trump plan to do? He's floated several options, including threatening to pull out of NAFTA altogether and impose a 35% tariff on Mexican goods. It's likely he'll first try to renegotiate the deal, but he's been vague about the changes he'd seek. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce and other business groups fear that radical revisions could wreck the complex interdependency of the three countries' economies and imperil millions of jobs. Most economists agree NAFTA could use updating. One popular proposal is to require Mexico to increase wages, labor standards, and environmental rules, which would lessen the advantage of outsourcing. But most economists do not believe that changing NAFTA or scrapping it will usher in a Rust Belt renaissance. Far more jobs have been automated than outsourced, says economist Zachary Carabel. Most of the jobs that disappeared over the past decades can never exist again. Period. That giant sucking sound. Third-party candidate H. Ross Perot roiled the 1992 presidential election with populist economic rhetoric, including fierce opposition to NAFTA. Like Trump, the Texan was a blunt billionaire who won a large following by advocating protectionist trade policies. Perot, now 86, created one of the more memorable moments in the annals of presidential debates in an attack on NAFTA. "We have got to stop sending jobs overseas," he said, warning that if business owners could move their factories to Mexico and pay a dollar an hour for labor, the resulting loss of American jobs would create a giant sucking sound. Whether Perot's zinger proved prescient is hotly debated, but his message resonated. He drew 18.9% of the popular vote and, most experts agree, enough conservative support to help Democrat Bill Clinton defeat incumbent Republican George H.W. Bush. Moving on to the best columns of the week. The first comes from the U.S. How to save the white working class. If we want to help the white working class, said Kevin Williamson, we have to persuade them to leave dying rural communities in Appalachia and the Rust Belt and seek better lives for themselves elsewhere. This idea offends some of my friends on the right because of a sentimental nostalgia for the virtues of small-town America. But it was only by moving out of crumbling inner cities and escaping their awful schools and social chaos that the ambitious poor created the black and Hispanic middle classes. Mobility works. Despite what protectionists tell you, no federal policy can bring back factories and revive manufacturing in small-town America. No company will heavily invest to build factories in blighted communities with few skilled workers. If the work is not coming to the people, then the people have to come to the work. How can government help? Republicans should adopt policies that encourage the creation of affordable housing in and around thriving cities. More immediately, they should use tax credits and unemployment benefits to pay people to move to where the jobs are. We can't revive devastated small towns, but we can try to make sure that for those who want better lives, geography is not destiny. This one from Poland. Why we are still choking on smog. A choking Poland has finally realized that it has a coal problem, said Marek Josefiak. The smog that settled over almost the whole nation throughout January came as a huge surprise. The cause of this pollution is obvious. The dirty coal that Poles use to heat their homes. Every year, we burn some 11 million tons of the stuff in inefficient domestic stoves, and even before the smog wave, we were suffering the consequences of our coal addiction. Poland is home to 33 of the European Union's 50 most polluted cities, including 7 of the top 10, and some 47,000 Poles die prematurely each year because of air pollution. Belatedly, the ruling Law and Justice Party is scrambling to enact some regulations to bring us in line with our neighbors, such as emission standards for our new heating stoves and rules on the quality of coal sold to the housing sector. But regulations aren't enough. We need to replace our coal stoves with greener, more efficient alternatives. Yet that would require taking on the coal industry, which the government won't dare do, because coal miners are among its most enthusiastic supporters. Poles seeking fresh air will have to wait for the wind of political change. And this is a How They See Us column from Japan. Japan's mixed emotions on Trump. Well, that was cozy, said Koya Jibiki in the Nikkei Asian Review. President Trump showed Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe an unprecedented level of hospitality during his visit to the U.S. last week. Trump held, shook, pulled, and patted Abe's hand for 19 seconds at a White House meeting, a bizarre ritual that the U.S. press dubbed super awkward. And the effusions just kept coming. Trump offered Abe a seat on Air Force One, a highly unusual honor for a foreign head of state, and jetted him off to the president's personal resort, Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida. The two dined and played golf and even bonded over a security crisis when news came at dinner that North Korea had tested a ballistic missile. It was like a honeymoon. Japan got almost everything it wanted, at least on security issues, said Mikio Sugino, also in the review. Trump recognized the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea, which China claims as its own, to be Japanese territory, and he thanked Abe for hosting U.S. forces in Japan. Abe should be careful, said Mainichi Shimbun in an editorial. Japan built its security around the U.S. alliance because America was the international leader in defending global values of freedom, democracy, basic human rights, and the rule of law. The Trump administration, however, does not necessarily attach weight to such conventional values. Trump has already pulled the U.S. out of the 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership trade pact and now plans to negotiate bilateral deals. Why? Because he thinks it will be easier for the U.S. to wield its overwhelming economic power during two-way talks and batter the other country into making valuable concessions. Trump's America is not out to lead the free world, but to grab all it can for itself. What is most worrisome is that Trump doesn't understand that free trade benefits all countries, said the Japan Times. Trump's campaign trail rants against Japan that it manipulates its currency and charges high tariffs on U.S. products were simply wrong. He seems to have formed his opinion about Japan's economy in the 1980s and hasn't updated it since. During the visit, Abe patiently got Trump up to speed, explaining how in 2015, Japanese automakers created some 1.5 million jobs in the U.S. by producing millions of vehicles in American factories. But it's not clear whether Abe succeeded in correcting the U.S. president's distorted views on trade issues. Nor, frankly, is it clear whether Trump can be trusted, said the Asahi Shimbun. Abe, preoccupied with China and its high-handed maritime advances in the South China Sea, where it has been militarizing its man-made islands, focused on getting Trump's pledge to defend the Senkaku Islands. Yet Trump also has the option up his sleeve of making a deal with China at Japan's expense. Japan may do better to start deepening multilateral and multi-layered ties with other partners. After all, Trump's honeymoons don't tend to result in lasting marriages. And before we move on, there's another short piece I couldn't quite resist. It's from the category of It Must Be True. I read it in the tabloids. A pair of drunken Canadian men were arrested after allegedly passing through a McDonald's drive-thru on a couch. Police in New Brunswick flashed their lights when they saw an ATV towing the couch past the takeout window, and the four-wheeled vehicle sped off, with the sofa still attached, a police spokesman said. The two men tumbled off the couch. The ATV driver got away. The couch surfers faced charges for their risky ride, but the police spokesman noted they were wearing helmets. So obviously, safety was somewhat important. Well, it's time now for the last word, our in-depth article, Awaiting a Revival in Trump Country. Crawford County, Wisconsin, was one of the Democratic strongholds that helped give Donald Trump the White House, said journalist Claire Gallifaro. Now residents are waiting for the president's promised economic renaissance. She tugged 13 envelopes from a cabinet above the stove, each one labeled with a different debt. The house payment, the student loans, the vacuum cleaner she bought on credit. Lydia Holt and her husband tuck money into these envelopes with each paycheck to whittle away at what they owe. They both earn about $10 an hour. And with two kids, there are usually some they can't fill. She did the math. At this rate, they'll be paying the same bills for 87 years. In 2012, Holt voted for Barack Obama because he promised her change, but she feels that change hasn't reached her here in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. So last year, she chose a presidential candidate unlike any she'd ever seen, the billionaire businessman who promised to help America and people like her win again. Many of our neighbors did too. So many that for the first time in more than 30 years, Crawford County, a sturdy brick in the once mighty Big Blue Wall, abandoned the Democratic Party, and that wall crumbled. The rural county lent Donald Trump 3,844 votes toward his win. More came from formerly blue counties to the north and to the south, and on and on. Some 50 counties stretching 300 miles down the Mississippi River through Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois transformed in one election season into Trump country. They voted for Trump for an array of reasons, and the list of grievances they hope he now corrects is long and exacting. Stagnant wages, the cost of health care, a hard-to-define feeling that things are not getting better, at least not for people like them. Here in Prairie du Chien, residents often recite two facts about their hometown. The first one proudly, it is the second oldest community in the state. The next is that it's also one of the poorest. There are no rusted out factories to embody this discontent. The main street of Prairie du Chien butts up against the Mississippi River and bustles with tourists come summer. Pickup trucks crowd parking lots at the 3M plant and Cabela's distribution center where hundreds work. Just a few vacant storefronts hint at the seething resentment that life still seems harder here than it should be. In this place that astonished America when it helped hand Trump the White House, many of those who chose him greeted the frenetic opening acts of his presidency with a shrug. Immigration is not their top concern, and so they watched with some trepidation as Trump signed orders to build a wall on the Mexican border and bar immigrants from seven Muslim countries, sowing chaos around the world. Among them is a woman who works for $10.50 an hour in a sewing factory, who still admires Obama, bristles at Trump's bluster, but can't afford health insurance. And the dairy farmer who thinks Trump is a jerk. Somebody needs to get some Gorilla Glue and glue his lips shut, but has watched his profits plummet and was willing to take the risk. There's a man who owns an engine repair shop and struggles to keep the lights on, and a bartender who cringes when he sees Made in China printed on American goods. There's also Holt, who makes $400 a week as a lawyer's assistant and whose husband doesn't do much better at a car parts store. She is enthusiastic that Trump started quickly doing the things he said he would, because she worries that by the time their sons grow up, there will be nothing left for them here. In this corner of Middle America, in this one small slice of the nation that sent Trump to Washington, they are watching and they are waiting, their hopes pinned on his promised economic renaissance. And if 4 years from now the change he pledged hasn't found them here, the people of Crawford County say they might change again to someone else. Catherine Kramer, a political science professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, coined a name for what's happened in her state's rural pockets: the politics of resentment. She spent years traveling to small towns and talking to people at diners and gas stations, and when she asked which political party best represented them, their answers almost always sounded something like, "Are you crazy, lady? Neither party is representing people around here." People have been looking for a politician who is going to change that, going to listen to them, do it differently, she said. People a lot of times don't have specifics about what that means. They just know that however government is operating currently is not working for them. In Crawford County, with just 16,000 residents, that dissatisfaction stems from feeling left behind as other places prosper. There are plenty of jobs in retail or on factory floors, but it's hard to find one that pays more than $12 an hour. Ambitious young people leave and don't come back. Rural schools are dwindling, and with them a sense of pride and purpose. Still, much of the economic anxiety is based not on measurable decay, but rather on a perception that life is decaying, said Jim Bowman, director of the county's Economic Development Corporation. There are higher-paying jobs in welding, for example, but companies can't find enough workers with the right training, Bowman said. The county's $44,000 a year median household income is $9,000 less than the state's, but the cost of living is lower too. Just 15% of adults have college degrees, half the national average, and yet the ratio of people living in poverty is below that of the country as a whole. Yet for many here, it doesn't feel that way. If you ask anybody here, we'll all tell you the same thing. We're tired of living like this. We've been railroaded, run over by the politicians, and run over by laws, said Mark Burns, leaning through the service window in the small engine repair shop downtown that he can barely keep open anymore. He drives a 14-year-old truck with 207,000 miles on it because he doesn't make enough profit to buy a new one. Burns watched Trump's first days in office, half hopeful, half frightened. He jumps on every bandwagon there is. It's a mess, he said, bemoaning what he described as a quantity over quality, sign approach to governing. I just hope we get the jobs back and the economy on its feet so everybody can get a decent job and make a decent living and have that chance at the American dream that's gone away over the past 8 or 10 years. Marlene Kramer gets to work before the sun comes up and spends her days sitting at a sewing machine, stitching sports uniforms for $10.50 an hour. Kramer, who voted twice for Obama, used to watch Trump on Celebrity Apprentice. I said to myself, ugh, I can't stand him. When he announced his candidacy, she thought it was a joke. Then my husband said to me, just think, everything he touches seems to turn to money. And she changed her mind. She's 54 and she's worked since she was 14, all hard jobs, feeding cows, pulling weeds, standing all day on factory floors. Now it's the sewing shop where she's happy and gets to sit. But there's no health insurance. Her bosses, brothers Todd and Scott Yeomans, opened the factory 12 years ago. They said they're trying to do the right thing by making sportswear with American-made fabrics and American labor, but they compete against factories overseas. They'd like to offer insurance. The other day, a trusted worker quit for a job with benefits, but they've run the numbers and it would cost $200,000 a year, far more than they can spend. Kramer says she's glad the Affordable Care Act has helped millions get insurance, but it hasn't helped her. She and her husband were stunned to find premiums over $1,000 a month. Her daughter recently moved into their house with their five children, and there's no money to spare. They opted to pay the penalty of $2,000 and pray they don't get sick until Trump, she hopes, keeps his promise to replace the law with something better. Some rural Wisconsin Democrats also think their party's leaders are among those who stopped paying attention to those just trying to get by. On the same day that Trump took the oath of office, a group of them huddled in the back room of a tavern, still trying to grasp how the election went awry. Bob Welsh met Hillary Clinton at a rope line in Iowa and asked her to visit Wisconsin, but she didn't come a single time during her campaign against Trump. And Welsh thinks that confirmed in the minds of many that Democrats are uninterested in white working people. Welsh wears flannel shirts and suspenders. He grew up on a farm, worked as a herdsman, and drove a school bus until he was 76 years old. He's 78 now and knows his neighbors as kind, hardworking people and could barely believe they voted for a man he finds reprehensible. But the left-right, blue-red vitriol that has cleaved the country has not left the same scars here, where wives reported not knowing how their own husbands voted, and husbands said they never asked their wives. Welsh said he hopes Trump finds a way to keep his promise to build his friends better lives. If he does that, he'll change my mind, he said, and I'll be the first to admit it. Bernard Moravitz hosed the mud and cow dung off the boots he pulled up over his jeans and headed for his truck to drive to town to talk to a banker about keeping his farm afloat. Moravitz, everyone calls him Tinker, works on his farm outside of town at least 12 hours a day, and usually a lot longer. He diversified to minimize risk and has dairy and beef cattle and acre after acre of corn, beans, alfalfa. The price of milk and agricultural goods has plummeted, and it's hard to keep things running. Change is what he looked to Obama for and now expects from Trump. He wants the president to reduce red tape and renegotiate trade deals to benefit American farmers. And he hopes people make more money and spend more money, which eventually trickles down to him. "I think he's a shrewd businessman," he said. "He's been broke several times, he keeps bouncing back, and he knows how big business works." He has several choice words for Trump's move to build his stupid wall. Moravitz employs Hispanic workers who have been with him 15 years. He built them apartments. He trusts them to do a dirty, difficult job that he says white people aren't willing to do. "A lot of people don't treat them like people," he grumbled. Unlike many transfixed by Trump's presidency, Moravitz doesn't stay up to the minute on the news. In the morning, he checks the agricultural prices and the weather. As protests over Trump's immigration ban raged, Moravitz wasn't paying attention. He took over this farm at 18 years old when his father died of an aneurysm while milking cows. He plans to die here, too. He'll retire when they close the casket lid. But if nothing changes and changes soon, he might have to borrow against his equity. Moravitz isn't sure Trump is going to make America great again for farmers, but he feels he had to take the gamble. "He might have us in a war in 2 weeks," he said. "We'll come back here in 6 months, drink a 30-pack of Bush Light and talk, because no one knows what's going to happen." He laughed, then shrugged, and pantomimed rolling the dice. This was excerpted from an article that was originally published by the Associated Press. I'll share one of this week's obituaries with you. The vocal virtuoso who crossed genres, Al Jarreau, 1940 to 2017. Al Jarreau was an orchestra unto himself with a soaring, lissome tenor and dazzling technique. A vibrant performer on stage, Jarreau was nothing if not eclectic, winning 7 Grammy Awards in 3 different categories, jazz, pop, and R&B. He was renowned for his virtuoso mimicry of musical instruments and sound effects, which earned him the nickname Acrobat of Scat. After Jarreau found commercial success with his 1981 album Breaking Away, which featured his breezy hit single We're in This Love Together, some critics derided his excessively smooth style. But Jarreau took pride in his jazz attitude, which he described as an openness to each and every moment, as a chance to create something different. Born in Milwaukee, Jarreau grew up in a musical family, said the New York Times. His father, a minister, was a fine singer. His mother played the piano in church. Jarreau started singing at age 4 and later performed with street corner harmony groups and local jazz clubs. Among Jarreau's early favorites were Nat King Cole, Sarah Vaughan, and Ella Fitzgerald. But his two greatest influences were jazz scat artist John Hendricks and the honey-voiced Johnny Mathis, said the Washington Post. After earning a master's degree in vocational rehabilitation in 1964, he moved to San Francisco, supporting himself as a counselor for the disabled while singing in jazz clubs at night. Beginning in 1968, Giroux devoted himself full-time to music. Working with a Brazilian guitarist, he learned to fill empty musical spaces with impressive improvisations and soon seemed at home in any musical style. As his career took off, Giroux earned comparisons to jazz greats such as Billy Eckstein, and said the Los Angeles Times. But his 1975 debut album, We Got By, evoked soul great Bill Withers. Giroux's next big release, the 1977 live double LP, Look to the Rainbow, included his interpretation of Dave Brubeck Quartet's jazz classic, Take Five, in which he breathlessly emulates three or four different instruments. That album would earn Giroux his first Grammy for jazz vocal performance. After Breaking Away went platinum, Giroux seemed to embrace a popular R&B sound. But he always defied easy classification, crossing boundaries and touring tirelessly until 2 weeks before his death. Music is such a balm, he said in 2012. It's such a heartbeat, like blood thrumming through the womb. And over on the Talking Points page, an article here titled The Resistance, a Liberal Tea Party. It's beginning to look a lot like 2009, said Kate Zernike in the New York Times. That year, horrified by a new president, conservative activists took to the streets under the Tea Party banner to resist Barack Obama's agenda, marching against government bailouts and storming meetings held by congressional Democrats in protest of Obamacare. The powerful grassroots movement swept House Republicans to victory in 2010 midterms, remaking the political landscape. 8 years later, said Vanessa Williamson in CNN.com, liberals are borrowing from the Tea Party playbook to mount their own resistance to President Trump. Constituents have overloaded congressional phone lines with complaints about Trump's cabinet picks, while five Republican lawmakers have been driven from rowdy town hall events packed with people protesting Obamacare repeal and other Trump policies. Could this be the left's Tea Party moment? It certainly looks that way, said Paul Kane in the Washington Post. But can this new liberal Tea Party build into a significant and lasting movement without dividing the party? Let's not forget that conservative activists directed their rage against Republicans, too, pushing out establishment cucks such as Virginia Representative Eric Cantor in favor of extremist candidates. The left's grassroots movement is already showing its own cannibalistic tendencies, said Molly Ball in TheAtlantic.com. Progressive idol Bernie Sanders was attacked by activists for merely suggesting he could work with Trump on certain shared goals, such as job creation. But while the Tea Party terrorized Republicans, it also strengthened them. A year after a crushing electoral defeat, the GOP won 7 Senate seats and took the House in a wave. Democrats would surely accept some infighting if it sparked an electoral turnaround. If the resistance means tacking to their party's far-left fringe, said Robert Trusinski in TheFederalist.com, it will prove Democrats learned absolutely nothing from the 2016 election. They lost to Donald Trump largely because they abandoned the white working class. To win back middle America, liberals have to focus their activist energy on economic populism rather than stage polarizing marches about racism, LGBT rights, and abortion, as they now seemed determined to do. Liberals may be building a new movement, but it may throw their own party even further out of the balance with the rest of the country. And we'll read a few shorter notes while we're here. More than 2 million of the nation's roughly 11 million undocumented immigrants live in just two metropolitan areas, New York and Los Angeles, according to a new analysis of 2014 Census Bureau data from the Pew Research Center. About 61% of the undocumented live in 20 metropolitan areas. The number of Americans without health insurance dropped from 17.3% in 2013 to 10.9% last year, with some of the biggest drops occurring in states that voted for Donald Trump. The uninsured rate in Kentucky dropped from 20.4% to 7.8%. In Arkansas, from 22.5% to 10.2%, and in West Virginia, from 17.6% to 6.1%. Press Secretary Sean Spicer's combative daily briefings with the White House press corps are pulling in an average of 4.3 million TV viewers, according to data from Nielsen. Audiences across Fox News, MSNBC, and CNN surge by an average of 10% when Spicer comes on screen. Almost half of people in their early 20s receive help from their parents in paying the rent. On average, parents contribute $3,000 a year to their grown children's housing cost. And we'll finish with a quote from Oscar Wilde. The man who says his wife can't take a joke forgets that she took him. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments, give us a call, 919-832-5138.